Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Madalena Berzi. Madalena Berzi, PhD, is the president and co-founder of Ocean Conservation Society. She has studied dolphins and whales in California and different parts of the world. Since 1990, Madalena has been involved in studying the ecology of marine mammals and sea turtles with a strong conservation bias. She has worked on diverse research and educational projects around the world. Among these projects, she organized and conducted the Yucatan programs in Mexico, two long-term investigations on local dolphins and sea turtles. In 1996, Madalena founded the Los Angeles Dolphin Project, LADP, in California, the first comprehensive marine mammal study ever conducted in LA waters. Under Madalena's directorship, LADP has become one of the longest-running dolphin studies in California and the source of many scientific and conservation publications and collaborations. In 1998, she co-founded Ocean Conservation Society, taking the position of president, where she combined her skills as a marine biologist with her experience as an active environmentalist. She has a strong academic background in marine biology, ecology, and marine mammal conservation, combined with almost 25 years of field research experience and 5 years of teaching experience at the University of California, Los Angeles. Madalena also has a broad experience as a writer, journalist, and television reporter. She has written 3 books and over 350 articles for local and national publications on science, nature, and travel. Madalena's presentation today is based on her new book, Dolphin Confidential, Confessions of a Field Biologist. Please join me in welcoming Madalena Berzi.
Good evening. Thank you so much for the introduction, and thanks for being here tonight. So you might be wondering what could be what kind of juicy thing a field biologist has to confess, given that most of the time we are either out at sea or sitting behind a desk analyzing data. You might also wonder what could be so confidential about dolphins, considering how little we know about their life. From the surface where I work, we get only a glimpse of their existence. So why confession of a field biologist? In the book, I talk about my life with dolphins, whales, sea turtles, and other remarkable creatures. But I also talk about my personal life as a woman and as a scientist. Growing up in Italy, with this dream to become a field biologist and studying animal behavior in the wild, wasn't always easy or popular for that matter. We Italian can be just a little bit conservative, and a woman's place was more in the kitchen than outside in the field studying large mammals. So the book opens a window into my personal thought, including my frustration, my successes, my insecurities, and I hope by telling my story, I might inspire others to care or care even more about the protection of the oceans. And what is really confidential about this animal are the many personal aspects of their everyday life that I was lucky enough to witness firsthand, which go to show you that if you spend thousands of hours out at sea, sooner or later you're going to learn something. And what I've learned from dolphins, above all, are all the remarkable similarity that these animals have with us. How caging them means really taking away their way of life, and why we must protect them. And I would like to start by reading you a short paragraph from my book. With my own eyes, I've seen the societies in which dolphins live and how they find companionship and build lasting bonds, just as we do. They thrive in open space where they can move freely, communicate with others, and learn the culture of their species. The eternal smiles on the faces of dolphins in a tank should not be taken as an indication of happiness. The signs of their true emotions are there, if we can only be sensitive enough to notice them. Dolphins in captivity are nothing like the dolphins I've seen in the ocean wilderness. I'm connected to the animal world by my humanity, not superior to it. My experiences have brought me face to face with animals in their own environments, where I have encountered diverse personality and witnesses an array of emotional responses. As a result, I feel I'm an integral part of nature, interconnected in the magnificent web of life. Now, I'm going to tell you how I started on this journey, along with a few stories and paragraphs from my book, without, of course, revealing you too much. If not, you won't be interested in buying my book, and I will lose my chance to becoming a best-selling author. So let's start from the beginning. As you can see, I've always been fascinated with nature. This was me, happy as a clam, with my first stuffed dog. And this is me, a few years later, some kid had dolls, but I really like animals. During my childhood, I spent many summers with my family camp out along this shoreline in a remote beach in Sardinia. And it was here that my first love affair with nature really began. In Sardinia, I explored the small creatures in the sand. I snorkeled in a sea full of life. I ventured inland among sheep and wild horses. My parents always let me roam free. They were never obsessed about safety. They figured that if I got pinched by a crab, next time I would just be more careful. And I did, and I was. Basically, learn from your experience. And I think it's a good life lesson that many kids today are missing. And that's what got me so close to nature since an early age. And if it had been up to me, I would have stayed in this natural paradise. But that was only summertime. Instead, I grew up in a succession of Italian city due to the itinerant nature of my dad's job. So as an escape, I created my own window of nature. And it really didn't matter if I lived in the city. For me, there was always a place to find animals. I had my little field book where I would write all kinds of notes on the animal I observed, from the hamster I kept in a terrarium in my bedroom to the behavior of a lizard in my mom's garden, or the habits of my dog Yogi with me in the picture. I spent hours every day in company of animals. Later on, I continued to conduct my naive observation with animals, mostly to offset what's going on in school, where animals, for the most part, were dead and seeing through the dissected body of frogs. And even being a student of natural science at the University of Padova in Italy didn't turn out to be what I have anticipated. The lecture had little to do with my idea of what natural science ought to be, and I felt suffocated inside the cement box of my university. I guess I wasn't ready for the kind of pre-programmed life that was unfolding before me, but everything seems pulling me in that direction, what my friends and boyfriend were doing, the city where I live, the conservative Italian mentality. So I realized early on that I needed to change something or had to throw myself under a train, and I began looking for a better way into the animal world. In my search for a stronger bond with nature, I began traveling around Europe, studying all kinds of creatures, from pigeon to snake to lizard. And when I turned 19, I also started working as a photojournalist, a freelance photojournalist, for a bicycle touring magazine. And that job gave me the chance to pay for my school expenses, but also live the life of a city dweller for weeks at a time. So when I wasn't taking mandatory courses at the university, I was either on my bike or filling up my Fiat 500 with camping equipment to be somewhere out in the wood. And on the bike, it's me armed with a radio to study migratory pigeons in a reserve in Sardinia and eating cookies. So dolphins hadn't yet entered my life, and studied the homing behavior of a species of lizard present in a natural reserve in Tuscany sounded like a good compromise between the strict requirement of my university and my total lack of money. So even though this reserve wasn't the wildest place in the world, and these tiny roving reptiles weren't the large mammal that I was really hoping to study, I was outside in the wild by myself for the first time in my life, and I was quite happy. The leap from lizard, beagle lizard, here I'm cuddling an iguana, and then to sea turtles and dolphins came naturally. At that time, my brother Giovanni was working for an Italian research institution set up to study marine mammals and support a research project with PayNeco volunteers. The institute was looking for somebody interested in developing a new sea turtle project in a remote reserve of the Yucatan Peninsula. The fact that I study lizard, reptiles, these were a completely different taxonomic order, and my willingness to stay in a remote location for months on end got me the job. And I was so excited that I didn't let the fact that I spoke no Spanish or the job pay close to nothing to get in my way. So began my six-year project in the isolated natural reserve in Yucatan, where I was the principal investigator. And during the day, I gave lecture, and we explored the surrounding. And at night, with my eco-volunteers, we searched for sea turtles. We were away for months of time from civilization, and I slept under the stars. At El Palmar, the research station was almost nothing. There was a fisherman's shack, and these are the fisherman's children, a couple of old buildings, coconut tree, and all around the impenetrable mangrove swamps. There were highly neurotoxic snakes, scorpions, tarantulas, and spiders of all kinds. And then there were also other unexpected dangers, such as drug smugglers, who arrive armed and by boat at night at the same time we are conducting field research. Here is one of my volunteers prepping sign to locate a new nest of sea turtles. In the background, the local military patrol looking for sign of drug smuggling. In reality, they came only once to see if we were okay, and we never saw them again. Here, from May to August, Haspil and other turtles came ashore to lay their eggs. And with my eco-volunteers, we used to walk up to 8 miles every night just to find them. And it's really amazing how these animals can find the same shores where they were hatched, sometimes from hundreds or thousands of miles away. And you really take your breath away to see these ancient-looking reptiles to come ashore to find the perfect spot to lay their eggs. We used to wait until the sea turtles start to lay their 180 ping pong sized ball eggs before we collect data. I know in my sense seems intrusive to you, but that was really the best time to collect information. Now I still wonder if the baby turtles will ever go back to El Palmar after they took their way out to sea. Threatened by pollution, coastal development, shell trade, and many other danger, these turtles are just a few steps away from extinction. One morning, In my second year at Palmar, I was sitting alone on the beach and I noticed a dolphin coming in my direction. And I immediately recognized Superhero, a dolphin I met here the year before. But busy as I was with eco-volunteers and sea turtle research, I had little time to think about dolphins. But the presence of Superhero and his companion was kind of difficult to ignore. So I started thinking about some way that I could include dolphin research into my research at El Palmar. So without either of us knowing it, Superhero and I have opened the first chapter on my life with dolphins. It was easy for me to get pointers from my older brother, John, how to study dolphins. On dolphin matters, my brother knew way more than I did. And Joe always was the dolphin expert, and then down the evolutionary scale and the food chain was me, the reptile enthusiast. So in the summer that followed, I began my first rudimentary study on dolphins, first from the shore of El Palmar, then from fisherman pangas like this one, and later on from this pier in another reserve in the Yucatan Peninsula, the Reserva Rio Lagartos. I moved the project here in the third year because between drug smuggler and poisonous snakes, life was getting a little bit too difficult. So research was going well, but there was still problem to address. For instance, the local kids at Rio Lagartos, the village where we were based, used to play war games with sea turtle eggs, using them as ammunition. So I started to think way that I could teach them something about conservation. And perhaps this was the first time that it had become clear to me that the pace of sea turtle exploitation was really outpacing the benefit of doing pure research. Then, as a result of my dolphin study there, something unexpected happened. I was still in Mexico when I got a call from my director back in Milan, and he asked me if I want to become the principal investigator for the first dolphin project ever conducted in the water of Greece. You can just imagine what I answered to him. So there I was on my way to the southern Italian port of Otranto, where the research vessel De Bolina and his captain Enzo were waiting for me to leave for Greece. And I had experience with volunteers, with sea turtles, a little bit with dolphins, but what did I really know about the dolphins of Greece? I was nervous. To make things even more intimidating, there was the fact that I had been on a research sailboat only once. And guess what? I got seasick like a dog. So my romantic idea of being out at sea studying dolphins suddenly clashed with the reality of being nauseous and green. So I was terrified by my upcoming months at sea. But things seemed to find a way to resolve themselves. I didn't get seasick, and somehow I managed to conduct a pretty good project. There were, of course, a few rough spots, like the dramatic mood swing of our captain. That was a little bit lunatic and insisted to eat pasta carbonara every single night aboard, which I'm Italian, I love it, but every single night it's a little bit too much. So began my great experience of being face-to-face with dolphins in the Ionian Sea. And I read another paragraph from the book that talk about my first sighting with striped dolphins. As we paralleled the school, the dolphins approached the boat to ride our bow wave. A kind of magic is beginning, and Ella, Sarah, and I scramble into the net suspended below the Debolina's bowsprit to be closer to it. Here we hang, with our heads upside down, just an arm's length from the water, the dolphins so near to us that we can almost touch their fluid bodies. When animal surfaces, grazing our fingertips, and a shiver runs down my spine. We are not speaking anymore, and it's clear all the three of us are feeling the same intensity. From our perch, we can clearly see the individual detail of their painted bodies as they move effortlessly and gracefully through their salt blue world. For the first time, I can see the shape of their eyes under what seems their heavy black makeup. There is something there that I have now seen in my work with other animals, a kind of knowing, of consciousness. It feels like they are as aware of us as we are of them. Time seems stopped. After that experience in Greece, I began doing research in the Ligurian Sea, tracking film whales like this one with hydrophone that allow us to follow them late into the night, listening to their conversations. Each species of whales has unique vocalization, and fin whales usually produce loud pulses at a frequency that is just below our audible threshold. These guys, with blue whales, can also speak at one of the lowest frequencies known in the animal world. And this research opened my eyes, especially my ears, to a world where sounds travel almost 5 times faster than it does on land, where there is a virtual cacophony of sound. There is sound these animals make to navigate their surrounding, to find their prey, to survive in a very challenging environment. Being a marine biologist was great at all, and traveling around the world to study dolphins and whales was fantastic, but wasn't really helping me to pay my bills. I was now living in Milan, working part-time as a journalist, but every time I went to sea, I knew that was where I was meant to be. And here is a little personal confession for you, seeing that the book is called Confession of a Field Biologist. In Milan, I met Charlie, a Hollywood native friend of a marine biologist friend of mine. Charlie was a sailor, and while living in Italy, was helping with marine mammal research. So we became friends, and then, well, something more than friends. So a couple of years later, I moved from Italy to Los Angeles to be with Charlie. And sailing on his boat in the Pacific, I found myself thousands of miles away, an ocean apart from my family, my friends, and my country. But it seems so natural that it had to be the right choice. And then before leaving, just to be sure that I didn't miss my country so much, I fill up my luggage with cheese and prosciutto and all kind of stuff. So that helped. I kept my project in Yucatan and some freelance journalist work, but I also started spending more and more time in the water of Southern California. I was astonished by the diversity of marine mammals that one can find there. And I was even more amazed to discover that nobody ever studied these animals, even if some of them, like bottlenose dolphins or gray whales, sometimes move really close to shore. That was an enigma to me, but I was captivated by the opportunity to be a research pioneer here. That was the beginning of what became one of the longest running program of marine mammals on the west coast of the United States and my everyday life in company of dolphins. Among the many amazing encounters that I had, I will always remember my first encounter with a blue whale at the beginning of my research there. And I remember being out at sea on a small 20-foot powerboat and this blue whale coming just underneath my boat. And I remember the blowhole of the whale to be as big as my caddy cabin. I really felt the size of a toothpick. Just imagine a small child can walk on one of the arteries of this blue whale, these animals, and their heart can be as big as my Mini Cooper. It's pretty astonishing. I managed to learn English, I guess enough to get accepted for a PhD program at UCLA, although I kept this good, strong Italian accent. And the title of my dissertation was to be, of course, Ecology of Marine Mammals in Santa Monica Bay. My focus was on this animal, the bottlenose dolphins, what I call my metropolitan dolphins, like the one with the sleepy eyes here. But don't be fooled by his sleepy eyes, because these animals sleep only with half of their brain, and the other half is always awake, so they can avoid drowning. At the beginning, my data collection in California drew from my past work, but it became more and more complex, and I needed research team, or what I dubbed the Los Angeles Dolphin Project Team, or LADP, not to confuse with the LAPD. Many of my research assistants became long-time friends. That is yet another advantage of this line of work. Spending increasingly more time at sea, I became even more captivated by this animal's social life. And I started observing extraordinary things that usually happen when you least expect them. And talking about extraordinary things, I want to tell you a story from the book. One day we were following coastal bottlenose dolphin, as we do on a weekly basis. Coastal bottlenose usually move less than 100 meters from shore, and they stop here and there to feed in circle. But that day, one of the animals in the group suddenly left the school and moved offshore, abruptly. And the rest of the animals started following him. That was very unusual behavior for the metropolitan dolphins, so I decided to follow them as well with our boat. We were about 3 miles from shore when the dolphins stop and they form a ring around a dark object. We move closer with our boat, and with my team we saw the seemingly lifeless body of a girl. She was pallid, she looked completely dressed, and she lifted her hand as a sign for help. So I immediately called the lifeguards, and they told me not to do anything until they would arrive there. And I decided to ignore their advice because I thought it wasn't a good idea. She looked very hypothermic. So we decided to pull her out of the water. We took her clothes off, and we tried to make it warm. She was young. She was foreigner because we didn't seem to be able to communicate. And I noticed she had a bag attached to her neck. The lifeguard met us almost at the entrance of the harbor. And later on, we went to the hospital to see how the girl was doing. And the doctor came out. He thanked us for our quick action. He told us that the girl was okay. He also told us that she was from Germany, vacationing in L.A., and as the letter in her plastic bag explained, she was committing suicide. And it was really then where I remember how we found her. What may the dolphins have done if we wouldn't find her, would have saved her? We have no idea. There are many accounts of dolphins saving humans, either by fending off shark or pulling the body of people toward the surface. And many scientists believe that dolphins, in fact, do not save humans because there is not enough scientific evidence. But that day, I followed a strange behavior of these dolphins, and by doing so, we saved this girl. Was that a coincidence? I'm a pretty skeptical scientist, but I'm still wondering today about what happened that day at sea. Not too long after that experience, Charlie and I decided to co-found Ocean Conservation Society, a nonprofit with the mission to conduct scientific research and educational program for the protection of the ocean. Our decision was just a little bit daunting, as it meant that our collective income suddenly would stop as soon as Charlie left his job and I stopped working as a photojournalist. But we decided to move ahead anyway and risk it all. You live only once, right? So OCS was the beginning of a new adventure, and the research became even more complex, which meant that now we require several cases to go out to sea. I had cameras, video cameras, computer, hydrophones, plankton nets, and much more. And things really change from when I first started collecting data only with a pen and a piece of paper. But I always try to remember not to lose track of what I really wanted to observe, and not to lose my sense of wonder and curiosity about the animal world, because it was curiosity and passion, after all, that brought me here in the first place. In the water of Southern California, I had the fortune to have many encounters with marine mammals and learn more about their complex life. For instance, following dolphins and sea lions for a long time and videotaping their behavior, I learned that sea lions actually take advantage of the superior ability of dolphins to echolocate food. And here you see a sea lion coming out with the head out of the water and kind of periscoping where the dolphins are going. I learned how to see the linkages that exist among different species and their collective habitat, and expanded my research to include all kinds of creatures, also seabirds. And here is John, one of my research assistants, collecting data on seabird with a PDA. Analyzing and matching tens of thousands of images of photo-identified dolphins, we use the dorsal fin of dolphins. They have not just the dorsal fin, and you can identify almost every individual in a school. I learned more about the local population of bottlenose dolphins. For instance, I found the inshore bottlenose dolphins in the Los Angeles area use the bay as a foraging ground, unfortunately often feeding near a stormwater runoff area. And then they move up and down the coast, and we have a statewide collaboration now to see the movement of this animal from Baja California to San Francisco and also to Oregon now. I learned how differently inshore and offshore population of bottlenose dolphins behave, with bottlenose dolphins be way more social and also acrobatic than the coastal animals. In this population, I also discovered they partially overlap. I discovered the bottlenose dolphins have skin diseases and physical deformities. This was the first study of this kind on the west coast of the United States. The presence of this disease is related to environmental factors like temperature or salinity, but it's also due to man-made pollutants. And this should be of concern, because it has implication for human health. Sometimes I get asked if dolphins avoid polluted area. No, they don't. And I really think it's our responsibility to take care of the oceans. Some of these research projects are still ongoing, and every year I add some new one. But my research have become more and more conservation-oriented over the year, because I do believe that we don't have the luxury to do just research. What we scientists are going to study in the future, if the Aspid turtle will never go back to those shorelines where they were hatched, or the few hundred individuals left of North Atlantic right whale, called right whale because they're the right whale to hunt, are almost extinct because of ship collision and entanglement. I think this is a good question we should ask ourselves. But for now, I continue my research, and for every hour that we spend at sea, we spend at least 4 hours out in the lab, close in a lab. And one thing I like to say to people that are interested, especially young people, they're interested in pursuing a career with dolphins in the field, this is an amazing career, but you really need to be passionate and dedicated to do it. And it can be a lot of work. This is mostly how I got here, but it's also how I choose my research assistant today. You can always learn about dolphins, but you can learn to be passionate and dedicated. To know more about whales, dolphins' purposes, like this doll's purpose, or other marine mammals, like this baby harbor seal without his mom that one day desperately tried to come aboard our research boat, you really need to read my book. But now I would like to take one moment to tell you some of the things that I've learned from dolphins and why we must protect them. I've learned about the simplicity of life. When you're at sea, looking at this animal, you really feel that little is needed to be okay. Some things I notice time and time again is how the ocean and dolphins, animals in general, can change people. I seen it happen with my eco-volunteers in Yucatan, and something I seen happen just off the metropolis of Los Angeles. I think we have this internal need to reconnect with nature, but we are so busy with our everyday life that it really slips by us. And we don't remember how much we need it. One of the things that I learned early on is the dolphins were not all the same. They were not just the object of my studies. They were single individuals, not solely for their scars and notches, but also for their personality, for their emotions. People often ask me if dolphins have emotions, and the short answer is yes. If you spend so much time at sea as I did, you can't deny that these animals have emotion. If you see the compassion of a mother in taking care of her calf, or if you see a dolphin grieving for the loss of a companion, it's extremely compelling. In the picture on the top is a mother with her dead calf. This mother stayed with the dead calf for over 2 days, continuing to pull the body toward the surface, hoping that the calf could breathe. Another dolphin went by and tried to take the mother away, and the mother didn't want to go and didn't eat. So, again, it's extremely compelling. I learned to recognize them as intelligent creatures. It's true that intelligence, like emotion, is difficult to describe. And if you look at the animal world, almost every creature can be considered intelligent. I can make a really good case for my dog, Burbank, here in the picture. He was a great enviro dog, able to deflate every balloon that we found in the water, and here busy reading the boat instrumentation. But as I explained in my first book, Beautiful Minds, only in dolphins, great apes, and humans, you do find that ecological complexity, brain complexity, a social complexity so strictly linked together. If you look at the dolphin's ability to learn and transfer information, to communicate, to remember and imitate, to take care of their young, you will realize how similar they are not only to great apes, but to us as well, probably more than we would like to think or even admit. Sometimes we follow dolphins for 8 to 9 hours, and I see how fluid their societies are, how their group come together and break apart, how they cooperate to find food, how they learn from each other. And then I think about putting one of these animals in a tank. What can be worse than that? So the natural world around me has changed so much since my childhood that I have changed with it. Traveling around the world to study dolphins and whales, I witnessed firsthand the dramatic change on our environment. For the first time in history, dolphins are disappearing. Dolphin species are disappearing under our own eyes in our lifetime due to our human impact. I've seen abnormal cauliflower-looking growth on the body of dolphins in the Indian River Lagoon in Florida. I saw physical deformities on dolphins in the Mediterranean, even here in California. I used to see huge lobster in the Mediterranean. Now they're half the size or they're gone. We already have lost almost 90% of our predatory fish. I'm sad when I think that the world I grew up has changed to such a degree that the encounters with nature as parents may become just a memory. If we don't act together and soon, some of these magnificent creatures won't be there much longer. But beside what the dolphins in that cartoon might think, I have a profound trust in our ability to change and become better human. And I think it's this trust that keeps me going. I've been in company with dolphins more than 20 years, observing their behavior, their similarity with us. I feel at home with them. They are in my life and they are in my dream. But I feel they still little about their life. And at the same time, I grow increasingly worried about their future. Real changes must happen to protect these animals, but what changes? For sure, we need effective ocean protection, and to get there, we need to see ourselves as a part of a grand natural system. And education, and more specifically, environmental education, can help us to attain that goal. Environmentalism is not an option, like choosing one's religion or political affiliation. My husband Charlie wrote recently in his book. Charlie, like me, grew up with a passion for nature that changed later on into a commitment to act in protecting our oceans. I don't want to seem overly simplistic. To save the ocean, you will need more than just education and passion. We do have some sound science on our side, but we need a tangible, measurable, conservation-oriented action. We need the effort of scientists, policymakers, economists, all of us working together, even if this means getting outside our comfort zone. I'm often asked what one person can do to make a difference, and this is a complex question, but I think a clear first step would be to cultivate a better knowledge of the issue facing our planet and then be somehow involved in the protection of our planet. One example, you can simply start by choosing an issue of interest in your community, then work to involve other people to impact the political process. We need to build a stronger sense of stewardship within our community. People and only government must shape the direction in which decisions are made. I believe each of us has a say in the future of the dolphins, of the whales, of the ocean and our own species. Exercising that say is our chance for greatness, perhaps the last chance. Thank you.
Our thanks to Madalena for her comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Dolphin Confidential, Confessions of a Field Biologist, with Madalena Berzi. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. I'll be passing around the microphone. If you have a question, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphone. And make sure to speak into the microphone as we are recording. Any questions?
Thank you for your excellent presentation. Last Monday, I was walking the Golden Gate Bridge, and I found around 40 harbor porpoises. And I wondered very much if you had mentioned the dolphins were seen in San Francisco. Do you know what type and where they can be found?
Yeah, you actually were pretty lucky to find harbor porpoises because they stay usually more offshore, and we don't even see them in Southern California. We have to go more offshore. You can find bottlenose dolphins along shore, not so much inside the bay, but along the coast. They are moving around this area more and more often. There have been a lot of changes with the coastal population of bottlenose dolphins, and before they never move past Monterey, but now they really move north of here. So you can find bottlenose dolphins. Then, depending on the season, you can find other species like gray whales during the gray season, so from November to April. And then you have to move a little bit more offshore, probably, to see other species around here.
We'll take next question.
Grazie molto.
Prego.
Thank you so much. I was wondering if those were your sketches, so you're an artist in many areas. I, too, am very concerned and passionate about animals, and there's so much loss of habitat and so many species, plant and animals, are dying, and we have a lot to do with it. But what can we do? And I know a lot of organizations need money, but not all of us can give a lot of money. I get petitions, but A lot of people don't even get letters from all these different organizations. You have to maybe join one, and then they pass on the information. But what can be done to save all these creatures? What are some things besides just talking about it?
To answer your question, first, yes, the sketches are mine. And second, it's a difficult question, but as I mentioned, just signing petition or just clicking on something in internet, I do not believe that it's enough. We need to do more, and I really believe we need to get outside our comfort zone. And I mentioned in the presentation that probably starting to be involved in your community, try to involve other people, that's a really good step. We need more action, and we really needed to do it now. We don't have much time.
And there are a lot of corporations that, you know, want to take their land for greed and to make their own profit without considering, you know, the species.
Yeah, but I do believe that people have a say in the future of nature, of what's going on, and we need to really exercise that power that we have, and we are not doing that enough.
And grazie mille for your presentation. It was fabulous. I have a lot of questions. Let me narrow it down to one or two. Swimming with dolphins. Lots of humans like to do that. What's your take on what dolphins are thinking and feeling and experiencing? That's question one. Question two is, there are many people that have intuitive communications with dolphins that say they speak to them, they feel them, they sense them. What's your sense of what's really going on?
Okay. Well, I have some difficulty to enter in the brain of a dolphin, so I'm getting there, but... I don't know exactly what they think, but what I can tell you is that, and I know that a lot of people here probably won't like my answer. I'm not really pro swimming with the dolphins program, not because I don't think it's a great experience. I think it's a wonderful experience. The problem is, how many people are swimming with the dolphins, how popular this program are becoming, and the damage we are creating to this animal. So the problem is not one person swimming with a school of dolphins. The problem is 100 persons swimming with a school of dolphins. We change their behavior a lot. You know, we have a lot of problem with people feeding this animal. And then the calves, there are scientific studies that show that the calves are not able to get their food by themselves anymore because they are so accustomed to bag that's the only things they know how to do. So to answer your question, dolphins like us. They are curious about us like we are curious about them. I really believe that they, you know, we are very similar in so many ways. When we go out with our boat, they come close to the boat, they look at us. Sometimes we are thinking they are studying us instead we are studying them. So they're curious, but I do believe we need to try to respect more the environment and going out on the water and see them. It's a fantastic experience. I think everybody should do it, but we should do it with more respect for their home. Intuition and communication. I do believe the dolphins have that power, but I do believe that almost every animals have that power. You know, a lot of people say, I want to swim with dolphins because I believe that dolphins can save my child or something. I believe that your dog can do the same, or a cat or a bunny. You know, really, looking at the animal world, you have this personality emotion in a lot of different species. So I believe that it's not the right things to cage on animals to give us that type of experiences.
It appears as if you started your independent research as quite a young and possibly naive researcher, and I'm wondering how the evolution of your research objectives developed and how you came to develop interesting and useful programs, perhaps on your own.
Yeah, you're right. I did start very, very naive. And I think it was very interesting for me to work on different species because they give you different perspective on how to study animals, including lizards. But the things that I really realized, mostly when I was doing study on sea turtles, is that we scientists make a big mistake if we think that we can do just research. It's absolutely not enough. Everything that I'm doing right now, even I'm still out on the water studying this animal, has to have some kind of impact or a conservation approach. So I did change a lot from my naive experience. Unfortunately, in a way, it would have been nice to continue to be naive for the rest of my life.
Any other questions?
Madalena, can you comment on the effects of the cruise line industry on the life of the dolphin? Because I know many cruises leave from San Pedro Pier and San Diego, et cetera. Is there anything that you would like the industry to undertake to better preserve these animals?
Yeah, actually, with our organization, Ocean Conservation Society, we are involved in some of the new regulation for ship on the shipping lane and the speed that they are using, and maybe modify some of the route of the ship because they're the same route used by blue whales and gray whales. And some of these regulations are actually passing now in Southern California. So at least in California, some steps are taken to try to protect these animals. The biggest problem, unfortunately, is still on the East Coast, especially with right whales, because there you really don't have too many individuals left. But thanks to the marine protected area in California, we are trying to take small steps. I would like these steps to be a little bit bigger, but at least there are some in that direction.
And I think I heard something about submarines even causing deaths to whales or maybe other creatures. And, of course, boats or sound of the
radio. There is a lot of noise in the ocean, and we are making a lot of it. The problem that I think you're referring to is with the Navy and the use of the low-frequency sonar. They can be extremely dangerous for whales, and there are scientific studies that show a correlation between stranding and use of low-frequency sonar in different parts of the world now.
What does it do to the whale? What does it do, the radar?
Create a problem, hearing problems, and then they can bring death. So they create trauma. The hearing system of the dolphins, and then they can die for it.
Okay, we'll take the last question.
We see dolphins doing tricks at the marine parks. I'm sure it undertakes a lot of training to get them to do that. You saw some pictures here, and I've seen in nature shows that they flip and they run up in the air in nature. What are some of the most advanced tricks you've seen dolphins, feats, let me call it, not call them tricks, what are some of the most advanced feats you've seen dolphins do out in nature, and how does that differ from different dolphin populations?
Well, dolphins in different parts of the world behave very differently. They really have their personality. Among the most amazing ones are probably the spinner dolphins in Hawaii, because they come out and they spin out of the water. That's pretty... They are not doing exactly the trick that you see in the aquarium, but are pretty spectacular. But even bottlenose dolphins, if you think that these animals are pretty heavy, as you see some of this picture, they can jump out of the water a lot, and that's pretty amazing to see when you're out at sea. So I enjoy my shows out in nature.
Thank you so much. Our thanks to Madalena for her comments here today. We also thank the audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.